The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Hi, guys. This is just such a weird day, you know? I was just spending, the past however many minutes on the internet writing a quick piece for MSNBC about Michael Jackson and then kind of reading what different people had to say. And, you know, it's one of those times where, I will return this to you for a small fee. But this is for the recording? Okay. I was hoping it was mine. You know, so much in this novel, which I'll talk about in a bit, but not necessarily right away, because it's an interesting day. But in my novel, Kiss the Sky, I talk about a woman who's seeking fame, thinking it'll make her happy, and why it doesn't. You know, why neither the pursuit of fame nor the achieving of fame makes her happy. And in that sense, I think that this is a really important day to think about that, where, you know, so many times we want to be better than. We want to be better than our weight, our height, our ability to jump or twirl or dance or sing or balance a checkbook, decorate a home, you know, walk gracefully across a soggy street corner. We just want to be better than. And not only just to be better than, but to appear better than. And so that not just so that we are better than, but that other people recognize it. So that they recognize our grace and our beauty and our ability to shine. And there are some people who really are much more gifted at achieving, at projecting perfection. You know, people who can shine and who you look at and who look wonderful and who have that grace and that carriage, that sense of self, and who can be in the back row of the choir, but you still know it's them singing. But that alone does not make a person happy. You know, fame or talent alone do not make people happy. And one of the things that we as human beings constantly struggle with is how to figure out what is the appropriate space for us to occupy between our loves and our talents? You know, some people love things that they're not talented at. Like, you know, when I go up for karaoke with my friends, I will sing all day, but I am torturing everyone. And I will only do it with my friends because they are willing to put up with it. But then there's sort of the other side of that. Like, we have to find, all of us, our space between the talent and achievement, and then people who are in that position of achievement, who are incredibly multi-talented, like Michael Jackson was, have to find that space between that achievement and a sense of self, and going back to a sense of who they are as people, and not just someone who's like, you're that person who, but who is this person? You know, and I think that, you know, I suspect that no animal besides the human species puts itself quite through these kinds of loops and figure eights. That there are animals like, you know, from dogs to whales who have a sense of community and pecking order, love, memory, but they don't necessarily say, well, you know, do I look good in these pants? How does everybody else, you know, how did I seem on TV last night? How's my Twitter feed going? You know, all these levels of self that we impose on who we are because of the modern age. And Michael Jackson, I suspect, had to be constantly followed by a ghost, which was the ghost of his younger self. And, you know, as he grew older and transformed himself through plastic surgery, I suspect he was constantly trailed by this cute little brown boy who said, what did you do to me? You know? And I'm very interested in why he did that, and I don't know that we'll ever know. but he was so profoundly ill at ease with himself that he couldn't stand to be himself, and so he became someone else, and then he didn't like that person either, and so he kept trying to be someone else. And the phrase, a pound of flesh, comes to mind, because he kept giving up a pound of flesh and doing this and doing that, and it never was enough. So in that sense, it is, a profoundly tragic story. You know, some people have used the word tragedy, and I don't use it lightly, but I do think his story is tragic. His story is a story of perseverance and achievement, but it's also a story of profound unease with the self, physically, spiritually, emotionally, sexually. And as such, it will make a series of great books and great movies, but I do think it also provides a cautionary tale, you know, that no, you know, there's no yellow brick road, you know, except that which you create for yourself. And there's not necessarily anything about being famous or rich or owning a chimpanzee and a merry-go-round and Ferris wheel that makes you happy. I think that happiness is something that's much more elusive and not based on not even these material things, but also the things like public acclaim. Like, you would assume that being loved by millions and millions of people, possibly billions of people, would make you feel loved. But there's a lot of studies about the psychology of love that talk about love being something that the receiving is as important as the getting. You know, millions of people can say they love you, but if you don't hold a space in yourself for that, and you don't believe them, or you think they're just trying to flatter you, or they're insane, or they want something from you, then there's no space in your heart to receive that. And I suspect some of the people who are very gifted, understandably, probably have some very bad experiences with adoration, and then begin to close themselves off to genuine offers of friendship and love. Because how do you separate, you know, Selena was killed by a stalker. How do you separate the fan from the stalker? That's work. And it's also chance. You never know. And so it becomes a whole cat and mouse game of trying to understand who's on your side and who's not on your side. So sometimes it makes you feel grateful that you just have to deal with your regular old crazy friends and family, doesn't it? I don't know. It all of this just makes me think so much, because I was someone who really was in love with that young man who could sing his heart out. And in some ways, I still am. I just wonder, the piece that I wrote as I was coming here, I was, you know, hustled up at the computer trying to write a piece. The piece that I wrote was really about, you know, it was very short, but it was like, how could he outlive that expectation of having this sort of parallel of this man that he could have been if he had grown up differently? And how could he live a life with that doppelganger, you know, kind of always beside him? And yet at the same time, you know, all of us do things that don't really make sense, and those things that we do that don't make sense change us. And none of us are ever going to be an exact execution of the every perfect moment that we could have lived. And so we also have to make peace with that. You know, we also have to make peace with the fact that we are never going to be the ultimate. If we had taken the left turn instead of the right, married this person instead of that person, or gotten this job instead of that job, what we can do is to continue to live as an expression of self and an expression of a belief that there is a future. And I don't know that he had that. So, all that heavy stuff there, I kind of wish we had a boombox, because, you know, I keep hearing that song, I'm going back to Indiana. You know, that's really, yeah, exactly. You know, that's like the early, you know, kind of, it was the Motor City vibe, Gary, Indiana. You know, that was really who I fell in love with as a young man. And, you know, that young man is the one you know, who shaped who I had a crush on, you know, as a young woman. So, without bumming all of us out any further, I'll talk a little bit about Kiss the Sky, and then we can just have a conversation. But this novel, Kiss the Sky, is something that I wrote in part because I did cover the celebrity scene. And I still sometimes do. But, you know, it's very interesting when you are someone who has access to people who are famous, because you realize they're definitely not happier than anyone else, and possibly less happy. And that, you know, There's so much machination that goes on around people who are talented individually and who have the ability to make other people money. And, you know, I remember once years ago interviewing a female rap star. It was like 10 years ago for a TV show. And then maybe she was not that famous. And then maybe 3 or 4 years later, I saw her in an airport. She was really pretty famous, and I saw her from across the airport and didn't go up and say hi, but she was surrounded by people, and she just looked so unhappy. You know, maybe she was unhappy in the short term, but I wouldn't be surprised if she was just unhappy. You know, she was constantly surrounded and guarded and chaperoned and told what to do. And some people thrive in that environment, but I think that it's very clear a lot of people don't. You know, and one of the things that we're collectively working out as a culture right now with all these reality shows is this fantasy we have that if only we were famous, or if only we were this, or if only that, everything would be fine. So this novel is in part about a woman who should know better because she works for a music video television network. And she should know how crazy celebrity is. And she should know how manipulative people are. And she should know better than to date her manager, which she does. But yet she goes, you know, she goes for all of it. She goes for the brass ring of celebrity after, you know, she had, you know, let's see. Trying to find a good place for you to enter the narrative. But anyway, she's someone who had a little bit of fame right out of college, was in an indie rock band, and this could be good. It's a little dirty. This is not PG-13. It's like, this is too dirty. This is too... Anyway, give me a second. Indulge me for a moment. What did you say? Oh, that's right. I love it. Yeah, not too much. I hear that. Well, part of it is also that I'll tell you as I'm looking through it, there's a... The backstory is that she was in a band with her... I'll just read the first chapter. That's always safe. I'll read part of the first chapter and part of the second. The long story is that she, being Sky, Sophie Sky Lee, is a black girl from Baltimore who went to Harvard, was in an indie rock band right out of college with her husband who she met at college, and then they broke up as a band because of his drug problem. And, you know, she hasn't really dealt with him in years, but a friend of theirs is sick and needs them to play a benefit. And so this is where we come into it. I don't believe in the devil anymore, but if I did, he would look a lot like R.E. Malcolm Klein. My ex has eyes the same amber color as his skin, with flecks of red gold in the iris as if you could see the flames licking behind them. Ari walked into our dressing room with just minutes to spare. This was our first gig in 3 years, for God's sakes. 70s punk rock CBGB style flowed into the dressing room from the club outside. He flicked on a red fringe lamp and leaned against a battered gunmetal school desk serving as the makeup table. I'd been worried about him, but he looked fine. Not just as in everything's fine, but damn, ain't he fine? still had his near-feminine leonine grace and economy of movement, a way of looking you in the eyes until you dropped your gaze. He did that to me right now, and when I lowered my eyes, I saw he was holding a small glassine baggie casually between his index and middle fingers. He lifted it, winked at me. "You want some?" he said. He was naked to the waist, a slight discoloration on his arm, where a tattoo of my name had once been, with the suspenders of his pants hanging down his legs. I felt like cussing him out. He couldn't be bothered to say hi or hello. "We're going to tear this up. You want some?" I took a deep breath and said, "No." "The only thing I'm on is Effexor," a little depressive humor. "I don't get high anymore." "Oh, you don't," he said, tapping a neat freeform line on the back of his hand. Then he held one nostril, and quick, quick, it was gone. "Well, it's here," he said, rubbing his sinuses, "if you want it." "I don't," I said. For one, I didn't even know what it was, not that that used to stop me. But whatever Ari was taking was always trouble for him and for me, and I didn't need trouble right now. All I needed was to get this right, just have one killer show, help our friend out, and see what manifested from there. The last time I was on stage was more than a year ago, just a 3-song solo set in Crown Heights at a showcase. Red, my best girl from college, had put me up to it. Tonight was different, though. David, who'd become our drummer after Red left the band, was riddled with cancer, had no health insurance, had a girlfriend and 2 kids. So a bunch of us got together to get him a little money to pay his bills and maybe save a bit for his girls if we raised enough. A month ago, I would have said that the chances of me and Ari playing together were about as remote as the Pope announcing that he was going to get married. But Red, who was here now fussing with my wardrobe, guilted us until we agreed to join the 3-band bill. We were at the Orchid, a place where the music critics went when they wanted to see what was next. And after college, when I was doing real music criticism, not just being the face for some 2-bit video show, this used to be my spot. I was one of the loud ones, you know, who would start talking about a weak band while they were still on stage, just to see if they could take the heat. Sometimes they crumbled, sometimes it made them stronger. I felt like I had earned that power, the right to make or break a band before their album even hit the streets. Now it was my turn to take the heat, and the decision to cross those few feet from the rows of couches and tables, from the darkness to the glare of the spotlight, seemed more foolish by the second. So that is the first part of it. And there's this whole sequence where basically Ari and Leo start fighting. Ari comes in, and, you know, Leo comes in, sees Ari, sees the drugs, and I will flash forward to it. And this is the little part where that picks up. "This isn't some high school talent show," Leo said. He focused his eyes on the baggie lying on the old desk. He picked it up, drew it close. Even from a couple feet away, I could see the powder's yellowish tinge and the fine grain. "Do the world a favor," Leo said, tossing the bag back on the table. "Keep this shit out of my girl's life." I'd been focused on avoiding a fight, but I got distracted by the words, "my girl." I liked his possessiveness, presumptuous though it was. I liked the fact that we hadn't even gone on a date, and he was claiming me. No one had in a very long time. "It's okay," I said to Leo. "Ari's just Ari." "And you are my queen," he said. The sound guy shouted, "Get the hell on stage." He was never one for niceties. Ari picked up his guitar slowly. I turned to Leo. "It really means a lot to me that you came out. And as far as, you know, Ari's stuff is concerned, I'm not tempted." "You shouldn't be worried about being tempted," Leo said. "You should get serious about making music your career again. That's the reason I'm here, baby, to see what you got. And you," Leo said, turning to Ari, "should get the hell dressed." Ari's words slurred slightly, so slightly that no one besides me would probably notice. He looked me in the eyes as he told Leo to fuck off. And then he turned, parted the velvet curtains, and walked out on stage. "Just let it go. I've got to go," I said. Leo said, "Yeah, you better get on stage." "I know you mean well, but you better get out of my kitchen," Red said. Red is her friend. And he did, if reluctantly. I'm not trying to stress you out, baby girl, Red said, but we should probably get you out of this shirt. It's too tight. I got a couple more things in my bag that will make you look out of sight. It's all good, I said to Red, but it wasn't actually. I was short of breath. My palms were sweating, part wardrobe malfunction, part panic attack. Damn, if I could have given all this up, I would have a long time ago. But music was my heartbeat, my oxygen, my bridge to the world. My demon, too. Oh, Jesus, it was showtime. So that's just a little bit of the beginning. Some curse words abridged. I'll probably read a little bit more, but I'm happy to take questions or thoughts, reminiscences about MJ, anything. Oops, sorry. Okay.
This is also parallel to Michael Jackson's death, but could you give your insight about Farrah Fawcett's death? Because as an African-American female, I was influenced by her in the sense that she was supposed to represent strength and pioneering in Hollywood during a time where she wanted to appear not only as a pretty face and a pretty body, but then as intelligent as well. And although she was placed in that movie, The Burning Bed, so many women had identified with mm-hmm. that part because of all of the pain that women had been enduring with men that were cheating. And as we have a society where more men are being highlighted in politics that have cheated on their wives and people kind of trivialize it, you know, her death, you know, just kind of represented that burning bed. So could you kind of also give your insight about Farrah Fawcett?
Sure, to the extent I can. I mean, I by no means am as up on Farrah Fawcett's life. But this is terrible, but a friend of mine who's an author said, I feel like the 70s just died, you know, and I do think that there was this way in which she symbolized this, you know, this moment in time. And I think, you know, the gender roles were really interesting, where I don't think she ever, the reason that The Burning Bed, among others, got so much attention was because she was playing in some ways against type, where she was always viewed as the body, and here she was supposed to be the soul. And I think that there has been a lot of struggle for women in entertainment to not be just the body or the soul or the sisterly one or the cute one. I don't know that she ever achieved a synthesis with those roles. And, you know, and she definitely had a big impact, but I think also, you know, something that just came to mind for me was that Michael Jackson's peak, you know, output was over a while ago. You know, he continued to do stuff, but it wasn't, you know, something that grabbed you. And the same was true with Farrah Fawcett. But Michael Jackson has, you know, it's a different level of talent. But I just think also that being fixed in time can be better or worse for different people. So although Michael Jackson has a sort of, you know, a repertoire of time periods in which he acted, in which he seemed very vital and innovative, that doesn't act against him. But with Farrah Fawcett, there was this whole lens of nostalgia that was put over her quite a while ago. And so I don't know whether, I can only imagine how that impacted her, to be someone who was always viewed as kind of being in the rearview mirror. Do you know what I'm saying? It's a hard burden to carry. But I certainly don't, I don't know as much about her as a lot of other people.
I have two things about exploitation, mm-hmm. one about women and one about black people. Mm-hmm. Like, I saw this movie Bullet not too long ago, and there was a Jewish family, and I'm Jewish, and they had two brothers that were drug addicts and one that was totally schizophrenic. Mm. And I was so pissed off about having like a drug addict. And I was thinking, if I was a black person, I would definitely boycott these movies, because it seems like you've rose to like the highest pimp or the highest drug dealer.
Right.
But in so many movies, the like, you know, like, thank God there's like black judges and black lawyers and black doctors and stuff, but the rich people are like the bad guys, and I would be like totally pissed off. And I want your view on it. And the second one that totally pisses me off with women, that how people are still portrayed as women, as everything is PC, which is good, because I don't want to be called a kike or anything, or you know, I don't want my friends being called fags or whatever. But they call women whores and sluts and bimbos and pigs constantly. I saw a little, I was over at my niece's house, and I saw an anime thing. So here it is, a cartoon. She's 12 years old. And she was saying, you're the whore of the world. And I'm like, a 12-year-old watching a cartoon? So I just want, you know, since you're in the media, I just mm-hmm. want your opinion on those two things.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think that women, it's one of these things where a lot of casual slurs against women are just more acceptable, you know, and a lot of times when I do work with young people and they're using the word pimp and stuff, you know, just, you know, casually, it's almost, the battle has pretty much been lost for the use of pimp. But, you know, they're using pimp, you know, pimp this, pimp that, pimp my ride, whatever. And I said, well, do you really know what a pimp does? Do you have any idea what a pimp does? Do you know, that the average age of a first-time prostitute is 12 or 13? Do you know what it takes to turn a girl out at that age and stuff? And when I break it down for them, they're all horrified. I feel bad. They're like little, they got big watery eyes and stuff. But, you know, but there's this, there's an amazing documentary actually called Very Young Girls, which is about a woman who actually came to the U.S. from England and became a sex worker here, and then founded a shelter for young girls in the sex industry. And most of them, the first time that they turn a trick, are between the ages of 12 to 14, because that's who the pimps can roll up on and who they can get to, you know, pay attention to their rap. Yeah. Well, but what I'm saying is, it's like, it's because people don't understand the concept of what the word whore means, and that it does have a root in manipulation. It's not just, I mean, like, if you call someone a bitch, arguably you can say, oh, well, that person is acting like blank. But when we have a very sort of casual use of language, and I do understand metaphor, and I use it all the time, and there's a lot of fairly raw language in here, but it's not used without considering it. And I think that one thing is that language is a playground, and throughout our lives we are experimenting with language, but the main thing you have to do is go back to the etymology and the roots of language. And so perhaps if there's someone in your life who's young or not so young who's using language, maybe you go back to the roots and say, well, do you understand this is what it means? This is where it comes from. This is why the word whore is a metaphor. You know, it's a metaphor for giving yourself up. But does it mean truly to give oneself up or to be taken? And just to raise those questions and have those conversations. I think conversations about the roots of language are very powerful. And I think that the more sometimes you get to the root, the more that you can make people think about the language they use. Because people use all sorts of language casually. You know, people talk about the N-word all the time. Is it a term of endearment? Does it mean something different in-house or out-of-house? And you have to go, everyone has a chance to use their own language and make their own choices about language, but you have to go back to the root and understand where the language comes from, so that at least you can defend the language you use and not just say it's because someone else told me or because I heard it from someone else. You have to make your own choices about language, because language is power. You know, language is a part of who you are. So, thanks. And after that, we have someone back here. Oh, I was just saying, either one. Yeah, why don't you go there, and then we'll come to you. I was just pointing out there were two people.
I was fascinated to read about that group that you belong to called the Finnish Party.
Yeah. yes, my sisters.
Yeah, and I wondered if you'd mind telling us a little more about it and maybe how they were involved with Kiss the Sky specifically.
Yes. So I belong to this great group called the Finnish Party, which you can find at thefinnishparty.org or .com or finnishparty.org.com because I bought all the variants of the domain. And that's the thing, too. If anyone here has not yet gone online and bought your own name as a domain, do it. Just do it. It's like $10. $10 a year and sometimes less. You'll be happy you did it. And that was, in fact, as like a as a geek in some ways, I bought my friends' children's names as URLs. And so when their parents get smart enough to want to create custom websites, or when they do, I'll give it to them as a gift. Because it's like, you know, there's a lot of people who have the same name, so get yours. In any case, I digress. The Finnish Party is a group of 8 women, all black, black and black biracial. There's one woman whose mother is white and another woman whose mother is Japanese. And the woman whose mother is Japanese is always making a point of saying, look, I'm as Japanese as I am black, and Obama's not doing enough to, you know, talk about being biracial. And that's like a 5-minute fight at every dinner party we have. And then we move on. We're like, Alice, just, you know, write him a letter. you know. But we are all writing sisters, and we have a broad span of ages, and we have a broad span of genres. You know, Lita Tatami writes historical fiction. Deborah Santana writes memoirs. Alice Dixon, who I was just mentioning, who hasn't been published yet, is writing coming of age. Nichelle Tramble, who's a successful TV writer, writes mysteries. There's someone who writes chick lit, someone who writes, you know, kind of New Yorker lit, you know, and so on. And we have a very mixed group of people. And we've developed a very specific way of critiquing each other that works for us. And I think that, you know, I'm very passionate about writing as a spiritual discipline, which helps keep you grounded as a person. Because I think, you know, one of the things that you've seen throughout the African diaspora and just throughout history, period, is that people need to tell stories, and they also need to find ways to express themselves that, you know, that may not be validated by everyone at every moment in time. You know, I don't expect my book to be validated by everyone, and I've been very gratified that it has been validated by so many people, but I needed to find a space in which I could create, and this was my space. And I was lucky to find a group of people who were really wonderful, and likewise, sometimes it's when I think that I have the least to say that I find I have the most to say, because part of being in a respectful circle of critique is that you have to challenge yourself to find that ground. You know, you have to challenge yourself to look at someone's work who you say, oh, well, no, I don't really have anything to say about that. But you really do. You just have to think about it. And so sometimes I'll get a piece of work where I have to really sit back and put my ego in check and just say, this is not about me seeming smart for giving helpful comments. It's about how much can I relate to this person's material, and how much can I offer them whatever bit of help I have, even if it's not particularly original or particularly smart. And I think that requires a lot of trust, because you do have to put yourself out there. And so we've been doing it for 5 years, and it's going really well. Are you a writer? Do you write at all? No? Okay. Well, you appreciate. Thank you. Okay. We had someone here, and then afterwards there's someone there.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm just wondering, your other books have been nonfiction.
Nonfiction,
so
yeah.
I'm wondering, this is your first published piece of fiction, I'm wondering how that process was for you. Was it more difficult? How'd that work for you?
Writing fiction was more difficult for me because it wasn't what I did on a daily basis, like doing this piece about Michael Jackson that I just did. However it turns out, for better or worse, and it took me, I would say a fairly long time considering how many words it was. You know, when I found out that I got off the train here around 5:30 and people were sending out Twitter messages, oh, we think Michael Jackson might be dead, and they were like, oh, no, he isn't dead, and da-da-da. And then by the time, you know, it was all confirmed, it took me about 20, 25 minutes to write something that was very short, but I had to come up with a thesis and a way to tell the story. And in this multimedia age, I was able to, I basically used the video for Thriller, where there's this whole prequel where he's, you know, talking to this girl, you know, I'm different, you know, and sort of talking about difference and how it did and didn't serve him well. Anyway, I know how to think critically about ideas, which is one of the things that makes you a good journalist or a commentator, but when it comes to fiction, it's a totally different set of skills and a different set of a different way of using imagination. And so the first thing I had to do was really let my mind kind of go free and just come up with all these things. And the book didn't really start out like this at all. And then I had to start... I really did set out to learn this craft. So I took classes at the Frederick Douglass Writing Center in Harlem. I was part of one writing group, then I became a part of another writing group, and finally I hired a woman who is a she's a script doctor, basically, who deals with structure to tell me how to revise my book, because I was kind of lost. And so I don't want it to be like, oh, I just came up with this book. You know, for better or worse... You know, whatever you do or don't think about it, I tried hard, and I learned, and I apprenticed, and I spent years at it, you know, while juggling my other job, because I wasn't trying to just pretend I knew what I was doing. And I spent years learning how to be a journalist, and I think, you know, you learn something new every day. But really what I learned with fiction is that you have to... learn your territory, and then at some point you have to impose. Some people start with structure. Like screenwriting, for example, is very much about structure. It's like you pick a structure. I took this great seminar by this guy, Robert McKee, who does the story workshops. And story is this famous workshop, and he has a book of the same name that talks about, you know, it's how to write a screenplay, but it's also how to tell a story and the difference between things that happen and a story. So, you know, for me today was, oh, I woke up, I sorted through my bills, and then my friend and her daughter came over, and then we went to the park, and then whatever. That's like life. But the story was, I expected to come to Philadelphia for the start of the second leg of my book tour, but while I was on the train eating cheese, I found out that Michael Jackson had died, and it flashed me back to my childhood and who I was then and who he had become. You know, that's a story. That's like, that's something about something. And so sort of separating the and then, and then from a story. And so when you start writing, you have, and then she did this, and then he did this, and then finally you have to make a story out of it. And so I spent a lot of time really learning what was the and then and what was the story. And I think that probably I have a lot of and then in this, but that's because I'm learning. And the people who are the masters of story, they get you from the jump because you are completely involved in, you know, you're like all of a sudden thrown into the driver's seat of a fast car on a winding road at night with the rain falling. And you have to figure out how to navigate things, you know. And I think that story, you know, story is giving you a sense of agency as things shift. And so the women in my writing group everyone has a different sense of what story means and how story unfolds. But it's all a collective learning. So we had someone back there who was next. And then I think the lovely woman in the red shawl and the gentleman next to her. Lovely gentleman. handsome, refined gentleman with the slightly troubled digit on his hand.
I wanted to ask you about your television media opportunities. How can you take this book and turn it into a screenplay, movie, mm-hmm. or, you know, and basically give us some details about how you want to portray it on, I guess, either on television or take it to the theater?
I'm trying to get it sold as a screenplay because I think it, thank you for saying that. I think it would be a really good movie. The problem, of course, is that almost everyone in this book is black. Not everyone, but almost everyone. Like the circle is that there's the woman, Sky, and her boyfriend, Leo, boyfriend slash manager. He's black. Then her ex-husband, who's black, and also is half Jewish, but then, you know, her other friends who are in the band. And then her two best friends, one of whom is white, one of whom is black. One of her best friends is a woman whose partner is an Asian woman. And then there's some white folks who work in the music industry and, you know. But the, if you had to draw a small circle, it would be mainly black. And the issue with that is that how do you sell an alternative narrative of blackness that isn't all about neck rolling, corn rowing, you know, sitting around church? There's church in here, but I wouldn't call it the main narrative, you know. There's neck rolling, but I wouldn't call it the main narrative, you know. And so I think that the thing is people have just started to figure out how to monetize blackness, but it's a very, you know, in many ways a traditional narrative of blackness, you know. Right. Yeah, I would love Jill Scott to play the main character. I mean, I would. She's got soul, you know? And she's sexy. And yeah, she's a sexy big girl. She would be a great main character. So if you see her in North Philly with her new kid and, you know, her husband, just say, "Hey, Jill, I think you need to pick up this book." But I'm serious. I'm not just saying that. I think she'd be great because a couple people have suggested, you know, there's many different ways to get a script sold in Hollywood. One way is a writer-based way where you get someone to adapt it. One way is a producer-based way where you get someone to buy the rights and you know, put it on screen. Another way is a talent-based way where you get, you know, the celebrity to buy into it. But Tyler Perry would F this up. So bad. That doesn't mean I won't cash a check, but I'm just saying. I'm just saying. Anyway.
First, I'd like to thank you so much for News and Notes. I listen religiously on NPR,
thank
so thank you so much for that. The question I did want to ask is, I know you are half Zimbabwean.
Yes.
And I am very much interested in Africa. I've been to Africa several times. And I'd like to know your thoughts and feelings about what is going on there today, particularly in Zimbabwe. If you visited, right. How connected you continue to stay to your African roots?
Yeah, it's the long story short is that I'm trying to make a documentary titled Half-African about my experiences with my family, but also the bridges that people who are half African and half American have made to the continent and some of the things that we've learned from these blended families, because many families, including Barack Obama's and mine, have one African parent and one American parent. And my mother is Black American from Baltimore. But these marriages, in addition to all the things of love and attraction, they had this kind of, they were trying to build bridges. And those bridges were very difficult because when you talk about a, when you talk about the kind of families that many African people have, which are not just intergenerational, but which are, you know, in Shona, which is my father's language, and he's now passed away, you know, my cousins are my brothers and sisters, and my uncles are my father, and my aunts are my mother. And that's a very, it's language, but it's also a true way that people view lineage and view responsibility. And that all sounds nicey-nicey and wonderful, but then when you translated that back to my parents' experience in the U.S., you found basically anyone from Zimbabwe came into their house while they were a young married couple and felt like, well, you know, we're your uncle, cousin, brother, whatever. And it put a huge amount of stress on an American-based household that viewed itself as, you know, kind of an individual family, maybe with a bit of, you know, extended family. And I think that there are certain things that go back and forth about obligation and bloodlines and expectations make it very difficult. And people are constantly crossing boundaries. And it's not just an African and American thing. It's different cultures have different expectations. You know, it's like, I can't remember who said this. Someone said that basically fish and house guests start to smell after 3 days, something like that. Huh? Who was it? Benjamin Franklin, there you go. You know, and so some people are like, 3 days, what do you mean, 3 years, you know? It's like, you know, it's like if we have any blood relation, I'm be up in your joint indefinitely, and you will help raise my children and, you know, whatever. And I just saw these constant misunderstandings about what the limits were of, you know, what a household could bear. And I think that that very practical stuff is a metaphor also for how we as America fit in the world. What is our obligation to be part of an extended family? You know, what's our need for personal space? And, you know, many of my friends here are immigrants or children of immigrants from different cultures, you know, from South Asian, East Asian, you know, African, European, and very often this idea of how do you draw boundaries within a family is very critical. That said, you know, I had to, you know, my parents got divorced when I was young, and then I went back to Zimbabwe and, you know, reconciled with my father. It wasn't as if we hadn't reconciled, but we hadn't seen each other in a long time. But I felt a certain freedom to really lay it all on the table. We had a great conversation, you know, our first time meeting about, you know, what our relationship was. And then I was able to open up, you know, much more to his family. And other members of my family didn't feel the same way because they were like, oh, he didn't pay child support, do this. Pardon me, do that. So there's this whole personal narrative, and then there's this meta-narrative of return. And when I go to Africa, I don't go as an African. I go as an American because I'm an American. I'm an American who is half African. But, you know, I'm not trying to – I think it's great for us to have a pan-African sensibility, but it is also important to recognize that people in other nations – like we wouldn't go to a Black American – wouldn't necessarily go to India and say, well, I'm Indian, but we go to Africa and say, I'm African. Why is that? I mean, we have a need for belonging, but do we recognize that there are over 50 countries with different languages, different cultures? You know, we expect people to know about our culture, but do we really know about theirs? And I think a lot of times there's this one-way street mentality where each side, and in this case I'm speaking of Africans and African Americans, each side expects there to be unidirectional understanding. Well, you have to, I mean, like, I live right now on the edge of Harlem. I live near 116th, and there's all these West Africans, like Senegalese, and then all these Black-born Americans, and there's so much kind of attitude, you know, because people each assume that the other side should take the time to know more. And the reality is it's a big world. The more that you can know about people, the better. And I've been very privileged to go to several different continents, and this fall I'm definitely going to India and probably to Malaysia, possibly to Senegal. I've been to 5 countries in Africa, but never to West Africa. And so it's a lifelong process. And it's also not as expensive as people think. I'm not saying that, you know, traveling abroad is cheap, but for the amount of money people spend on hair and nails and, you know, Red Lobster, you could get yourself out of the country and maybe go visit someplace. You know what I'm saying? So, anyway.
My question, I saw at least one broadcast where you were covering Obama during the election.
Right.
I think you were on the roof and it was a real windy day.
Oh, it was probably...
I think it was for BET, maybe.
Yeah, BET, during the inauguration.
But my question was, how was your experience covering the election, and how's your experience been post the election?
Well, it's complicated because, of course... News and Notes was canceled right before the inauguration, and we remained on the air for a while, but it was a very tough situation. Like, when I covered the inauguration, I just felt so burnt out, you know? It's like we had done our best to really try to provide news about this major event, and I had interviewed Obama twice, and then we were just kind of shown the door. But I will say that one of the things I really learned was that it, you know, although there were things that were personal and there were things that I took personally, the whole situation was not personal. This company was in total disarray. The media business is in disarray. And we did as much as we could to save the show. And, you know, we basically saved it twice when it could have been canceled earlier. And so when I went to D.C. for the inauguration, I was just kind of beaten down and worn out, and yet I realized that I needed to be there for the sort of finish line of this whole process. But the moment that I really enjoyed the most was being in Invesco during Obama's speech accepting the nomination for the presidency. And I was able to, you know, pull out my decoder ring, because he used phrases like a dream deferred, you know, which I think many of us understand coming from Langston Hughes, and then A Raisin in the Sun. And some people have criticized Obama for not being black enough, but also for not invoking blackness enough. And what I tried to point out, was how he was using all these signifiers of blackness that you could pick up on if you knew, or if you didn't know, they were just part of the subtext. I hear that people know what I'm talking about, you know, and that was the most fun part of the journey for me. And also I have been doing some guest hosting on The Takeaway for WNYC, and someone said, yeah, I was sitting in this place in, I think he said he was in Kampala. He's traveling with his wife, and he's like, I was sitting in Kampala and listening to the radio of Invesco, and then I heard you do this whole thing on A Dream Deferred. And I think that sometimes people are just waiting for that moment where things are made clear to them about what they're already listening to. Like, they're listening already, but then there's these things that kind of pass over their head. And I like it when we can share a moment on a deeper level, you know? So at this point, I'm talking to a lot of people in the media industry about, you know, what might be next. And I have refrained to a remarkable extent from just saying, oh, I'm going to take this job or that job, because there's jobs out there. But I don't really know what I want to do yet. I don't want to wait too long, but I'm still working. You know, I work at this and I work at that. But I really, you know, I do want to, instead of just looking ahead to, you know, do I want to do this one thing now, I'm really saying, well, what are the needs of this country during the 2012 election? And trying to work backward from that and put myself in a position so that I can do some good coverage there. And instead of just being purely reactive, be proactive about how I craft my career. Your choice. And then, I guess you. And then you. Oh, is that the high sign? Okay. Well, I'm going to make a suggestion then, because there were two people who raised. Can you ask your question, and then we're going to get your question, and then I'll fold them up into the high sign, wrap them up. Is that okay?
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay.
And then, I'll make it quick then. I just have a question about the lack of black journalists in the international media, mm-hmm. especially I was watching the events in Iran right now and talking about how the Western media, you know, a lot of journalists that were there from the Western media were asked to leave. And I was just thinking about, I wonder if any African-American journalists from the U.S. were actually allowed to go to Iran and actually do objective coverage there. And just thinking about whether or not blacks in the media have to combat negative stereotypes worldwide when trying to do journalism on an international scale. So,
great. And I'm going to ask for your question, too, and roll them both up. Right here.
Actually, a journalism-related question. I was going to ask more generally what your thoughts are about the future of journalism.
Okay. Yeah, the good news is that there is a future. What that future will consist of, I'm not entirely sure. I think I had a moment where I pitched a bit of a hissy fit around. There's a lot of talk about creating new profit models for media, but it doesn't necessarily take into account the need to reconceive media as a space that is more socially just and more inclusive. And even if we get back to the best days of media as it has been, we still won't have done our jobs, because media has always been used as a tool to shut people out, to not listen to communities, etc. And so I raised a bit of a fuss about that in a forum, and I'm trying to figure out a way to do it constructively. I don't know. I mean, Iran is a very tough example because so few Western reporters are on the ground. I don't know of any black reporters who are there. There may be other reporters of color who are there. I certainly would love to be there, but, you know, I think that at this point the door is closed, except if people are willing to sneak in, which is very dangerous, as you've seen with, you know, Lee and Laura Ling. But there are some great people, like Mara Schiavo-Campo, who's of NBC, MSNBC. She's their digital correspondent. She's someone who is black and who has pioneered a lot of digital journalism, spent a lot of time in war zones. People like that are the kind of people who do some really amazing things. I think that with journalism, there's going to be a lot of reliance on what's called citizen journalism, which means you guys have to report the news. And so I believe that there's an over-reliance on citizen journalism right now, but that every community should have a seat at the table, and that as people talk about moving from models of having newscasters and people who are out in the field to getting people in communities to contribute news, people need to be at community meetings and so on, saying, okay, well, who's on our team? And are you going to send anyone to train people? And are you going to provide broadband access? Things like that are important. I'll read one last piece. It's only a couple paragraphs because I know we got to go. But this, there's a sequence set after 9/11, and this is literally about five paragraphs. And it says, it's the character walking around her neighborhood. On the next corner, there was a crowd. It was a drab storefront mosque blended in with aging storefronts now besieged by screaming people. This wasn't how people in my neighborhood acted, or at least that's what I thought. I drifted towards the melee and accidentally got shoved in the middle between people shouting on the curbside and those shouting back who flanked the mosque wall. A couple of cabs passed and people ran after them to try to get in, but they had their off-duty lights on and ran the red lights. Back to the protest, if that's what it was. One group of people shouted, "Go home, Arabs." Another group screamed at the first, "No, you go home." The people who actually went to the mosque, men in kufis and women wearing the hijab, stood silently by the doors and let the others duke it out. Mind you, the folks screaming go home were not dolled up like racist skinheads or wearing Klan robes. Everybody looked like what passed for each East Village normal to me. I stood in the center of the screaming, just looking around. A woman in blue jeans and a trendy top said, "Go home, Arabs." "No, you go home," said a different woman. She was wearing a vintage tennis dress. It was hard to tell the good guys from the bad guys. They all looked the same. Thank you. And when you go home, don't forget to play your Michael Jackson.
Folks, please join us upstairs.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.